Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
So the starting point was casting Jason Sudeikis. He was just before he went on to do Ted Lasso. Great timing by me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You totally knew that was going to happen.
Yeah, right? That's right.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Barrett Scher.
Hello.
And Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And today we have a very special guest. It's director and co-writer of a movie called South of Heaven, Aaron Kashalis. Aaron, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We love talking to filmmakers and everything. This movie comes out in theaters, VOD, and digital on October 8th. It's a very unusual movie, by the way, and you know this. I mean, you hate it. But what's funny, what's great to me about this is you made a movie where there's almost every action has a consequence, and they don't have to necessarily be linear consequences if you're just following along in the movie and everything. So what was the creative process like when you were writing this with your co-writers?
It started off weird enough with my honeymoon. I got married at a very, very late age of 37. She was 39. She was a fantasy of mine. She was a news anchor lady. I was obsessed with her since I was 18, but I never had the chance to do anything with it until I premiered my movie, Big Bad Wolves, and invited her to watch my new movie just as a VIP. And then I started, would you like to have some coffee? And then we got engaged. And then, you know, when you are engaged and you're in love in a very, very late age and you go on a honeymoon, you try to compensate for 20 years of not being there with her. And not wanted to be, you know, I couldn't be with her when she was 20 and 25 and 30, and she couldn't be with me. So you try to squeeze all those great experiences into what came to be half a year of a honeymoon around the world, right?
Wow.
So during that honeymoon, I came with an idea of making a movie about a guy who went to prison for a long time and robbed his wife of their, you know, his fiancé of their happiness. And now when he gets out, he wants to give her that, you know, 12 years back, but he only has 1 year to give it to her because she's dying. So that was like the main idea I came up with during my honeymoon. And it was supposed to end with the car accident. You know, the turning point was supposed to be a car accident that ruins everything I want to give her. So because I cannot think only about optimistic things, you know, even in my honeymoon, I'm thinking about death. That's the way I'm programmed. Like, that's why I did the first Israeli horror film, then the second Israeli horror film, because I'm obsessed with death, I guess. So even in my honeymoon, I was like going dark. But then when I came back to, you know, to Israel after my long honeymoon, I sat with my co-writers and then we tried to think about, you know, what would be the car accident? What would it involve? And then, you know, it's like this crazy writer's room that one guy says, yeah, well, maybe he hits the biker, and the biker is like a guy who works for a kingpin, right? And that takes the movie into a new direction. And what if the kingpin is a kid? And now he needs to do, you know, he needs to kidnap the kid. Like, so you try, you just try to put everything on a wall, right? Everything that could go wrong. I'm a big believer that everything that can go wrong will go wrong, especially in movies, because it makes for, you know, more fun cinema. So we just, you know, played with everything until we said, well, that's too much. We cannot go further than that without losing the you know, the spectators, the audience. That will be a little bit over the top. So you needed to come into a place where you go crazy, you go batshit crazy at time, but try to, you know, be within something that people will not lose the emotional anchor. And that was the most important thing for me to do, because it is a movie, you know, it is a romantic movie that goes terribly wrong.
Yeah, it's like almost anything can happen in this. Did you have a bunch of ideas that you just didn't use? Like, did you go that far where you had like a, you know, I'd like to go in this direction, and then you just ran into a wall or something? Or did you guys come up with all the ideas that, and they all ended up in the movie?
Most of the ideas came to be in the movie. Some of the ideas became more, you know, dangerous or more brutal. Like, let's say we started off with an accident. I thought that during his time in prison, his eyesight goes a little bit off, right? So he goes to the doctor who checks his eyes, and they put this shit in your eyes, right? And then he can't see very well. And when he goes out and he's just riding his car, he just killed an innocent man. It wasn't supposed to be related to another, you know, plot in the movie, right?
Right.
We have the parole officer. But then I talked about it with my co-writers that I always wanted to do like the opposite Psycho movie where, you know, Janet Leigh dies at the midpoint of the movie. So I want to do something like that. I don't want to give a spoiler here, but I want to do something like that only with, you know, villains. Like you could change a villain. You could do something there. And then we came up with the idea that, you know, maybe the biker isn't just an innocent bystander. Let's get that biker to be related to another entity in the movie that will be the second, you know, villain of the movie. And that will be a big, big, big surprise for everybody who's going to see it. So this is an example where we thought about something, but then we got more brutal. Usually that's the way we think. Like we, you know, is it brutal enough? Is it painful enough? Is it crazy?
It's like you are killing me, Aaron. This is so much fun. This is exactly, if I were to draw a sketch of a person that directed this bonkers movie, it would be you. I really appreciate that you are a reality.
Thank you. It's like we have babushkas. It's like the dolls that they're dolls within a doll. You know that doll? So that's how we like to write movies. Like, what will be the craziest doll that you could pull up out of the other doll, right? So that's the process usually. Like in Big Bad Wolves, you start with a crazy father, but then you learn that he has a crazier grandfather who used to torture people during the military, military service, so he could do a better job than his kid.
No, I've seen Big Bad Wolves. I think this conversation is surprising me less than it is Bear Grylls.
Yeah, you mentioned the romance in here, and it's an unusual romance as well. I mean, this is it's funny to me. Evangeline Lilly, towards, you know, somewhere like 2/3 through the movie, tries to explain it, like, oh, there's this, there was this pact of some sort or whatever, but it feels like sort of an excuse because even she realizes how, insane the love between her and Jason Sudeikis's character in this is and everything. But how do you make that relationship believable? Because this is, you know, she has been waiting 12 years and they've known each other for so long.
For me, you know, I'm this guy. That's the other side of me. Like, I'm a total romantic guy. At the same time, I'm very cynical and very brutal. I have those two. Like, you know, she says about herself that she's bipolar because she's dying. I think I'm bipolar without dying. So I have those two poles in my personality where I could love to death, really. When I give love, it's like all the way, no. So what, when I write about romance, I just feel you need to tap into that in the most pure way. And because I made this movie especially for my wife, I wanted to make a movie that, you know, it's 100% love. And I thought that, you know, by making them so united together, and the fact that it's such a crazy, almost, you know, unbelievable love story, everything that will happen in the middle of the movie will be of greater impact, because you just don't want them to fail, and you just want them to be together. As for, you know, convincing the audience, I'm a big believer that if you have like a good scene in a movie that takes you out of the genre, you could go away almost with everything. And I learned that from the great Sam Peckinpah, because Sam Peckinpah, you know, when he did his, I call it broken films, the ones that didn't go well at the box office, like Pat Garrett or Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. So you could see that even in those brutal films, he has those moments where he gives you something so real in romance that, you know, if I would tell you that in the middle of Alfredo Garcia, the hero, Billy, sits down, the protagonist sits down by a tree with a girl he once loved, but he never proposed to her. And the entire scene is about, why didn't you propose to me? And he's like, you're right, I never proposed to you. I should propose to you. And then he proposes to her in the same scene. Then minutes later, there's that Chris Christopherson brutal scene. Mm-hmm. And it's seconds later. But what he does in a film like that, and almost in every good Sam Peckinpah movie, is that something real and honest happens. And I'm a true believer that if you make those moments in a movie, and if you look for them in genre movies, they will allow you or help you convey something that is almost totally unbelievable. If I told you that, you know, just in the streets, like if we talk about, you know, Parrot, Garrett and Billy the Kid, Slim Pickens is getting shot in the gut, but then he has that beautiful romantic moment by the river looking at his Mexican wife, and Peckinpah shows it for like a minute. He looks at her, she looks at him, it's muted. It's one of the most beautiful romantic death scenes ever to be filmed. But you see it, and it works.
Yeah, yeah. You obviously have some extremely likable actors in here. Jason Sudeikis is our lead, Evangeline Lilly, Shea Whigham, Mike Coulter, and you even have Michael Paré in this too. Tell me how you cast this, who you were, you know, what you were looking for, and what it was like to work with these people.
So the starting point was casting Jason Sudeikis. He was just before he went on to do Ted Lasso. Great timing by me.
Yeah, absolutely.
You totally knew that was going to happen.
Yeah,
right?
That's right.
Yeah, of course. I knew everything. I knew, of course. I didn't even know he wrote something back then, because it was very secretive. So, you know, I like to work with comedians against typecast. I did it in Big Bad Wolves with some of the best comedians. The grandfather is like our John Cleese. Was our John Cleese. So when I come to cast, I usually like to look for a little bit of surprise, because it gives you some kind of edge to the character. And Jimmy Ray on the paper is, you know, is a broken man. He isn't really a tough guy. I didn't want him to be like, you know, when you cast movies like that, the first names that you will be offered, of course, are the big, you know, action heroes like Jerry Butler and Jason Statham, Keanu Reeves of the world, which, you know, you could enjoy those films. But I felt that this is a more romantic movie. It needs somebody that has a little bit more down to earth kind of feeling, a working class hero, and somebody that has the biggest puppy eyes you could ever imagine. So when bad things will happen to him, you're just gonna feel so bad about it.
And then
I started watching a lot of movies with Jason Sudeikis, and I caught something in his performances that he has, you know, in his best role, he has this kind of honesty to him, And in his weird movies like Colossal, which I really like.
Love Colossal, yeah.
He shows a side that you never seen, and not a lot of people talk about his performance in Colossal, but it's one hell of a performance and one hell of a movie. So I saw Darkness to him, and then I said, he has crazy eyes. Nobody talks about Jason Sudeikis crazy.
Yeah.
When he gets mad, you know, when his eyes are like burning, it's like, you know, it's the Shining time here. So I saw both sides of him while watching his tapes, and I was like, I need to, you know, we need to try and you know, do this with him. And he was like, I think at the same time he was looking for projects that will get him out of his, I think, comfort zone as a comedian. And he was looking for something, you know, darker, more dramatic. And I guess that was a match made in heaven, because I was looking for, you know, him, and he was looking at the same time for strips like that. And, you know, he wanted to meet with us, great meeting, and it started with him. And then you need to match, of course, the actress. And, you know, Evangeline Lilly is always like great in everything she does. She has always great chemistry with her co-stars, if it's Paul Rudd or, you know, the guys who played her lovers on Lost, everything.
Yeah.
So we just, you know, hooked them up like a Jewish dating show. like a Jewish grandmother looking for like good matches. So it happened. And they were so great. Even before we started shooting, they started texting each other, meeting each other, flirting as actors do. They're flirting in order to get to make sure it's going to work on screen. And then we just know. But the wonderful thing about working with these set of actors is that they all came with a very precise notion of how they want to play their roles and even enhance the story and help the script with their notes and their attitudes towards those characters. Like Jason wanted to play Jimmy as a broken man, not only like, I remember the first scene when he comes out, the second scene when he comes out of prison, he was like, I don't want to play it like he's happy. And, you know, it's like, woo, there's my lover and hug it, let's hug. And it's all cheesy. And no, I want to be broken about it because I'm happy to see her, but I know she dies. And I know that I robbed her of her best year of her life. So he said, I'm going to play the entire comedy beats event during this film as if I'm not in on the joke, because I don't want it to be with a wink in the eye all the time. So it's like everybody knows I'm on the joke and it's become this comedy again. I'm going to be really invested in this character, almost methoding Jimmy Ray, just so people feel the you know, the heaviness of my character, of anything that I've lost during these years. And then when the comedy happens, and I like to direct comedy like that too, is above the character's head. They're not in on the joke. The audience might laugh of the situations and how crazy it is, but he's never on the joke. And Evangeline came with the idea to take that I'm bipolar sentence during their Beach Boys scene on the bench and enlarge it to the entire and make it for her character, like she's bipolar. She could laugh, she could cry, she's tough, yet she's fragile. So it won't be like this, you know, damsel in distress that you see in most movies. Like she could hold her own against Price. She could hold her own against Schmidt. She could hold her own in any situation. She could say, Jimmy, stop it, you know, and she's not taking shit from anybody. So that was great, you know, output from her, because when you are a writer and a male writer, you need that output when you make action movies, because otherwise, you know, you just do the same mistakes. And she wanted me to, you know, bring something more profound to her character. And I think that's why there's like this great chemistry between them. And that's why maybe you want them to, you know, be okay at the end of the movie and not just, you know, the way it is.
Yeah, I really love that Beach Boys scene, because it shows that she's got a sense of humor about how everything's going. And I like his reaction, because he doesn't really quite get it you know, quote unquote, you know, he doesn't like the idea of this being her funeral song and everything. God only knows. It reminded me of when in To Die For, Nicole Kidman plays All By Myself at the funeral and everything. You know, it's a very dark humor moment. I loved it. So getting back into the casting, you have Shea Whigham and Mike Coulter, and these guys are awesome as well. They're the movie's villains. Tell me what it's like to work with them as well.
Well, Shea Whigham, probably one of the best character actors working today in the U.S.
Yeah.
in my opinion. And you know, when you write a movie, I knew it was going to be like the modest of modest budgets, and you know, 25 days of shoot, very strict budget. And I was like, you know, who can we? I dreamt about casting Shea Whigham when I wrote the character, but I had no idea I will be able to get him. Also, you know, Jason Evangeline, of course. But when you go into those characters, I said, well, it is not for the whole movie, and I hope he will be, you know, fall in love with the script or the character, and it just comes along. And it did happen. Like, he read the script, he said it's a great character, and I want to do it. Now, working with Shay is the greatest experience of all, because he's like,
I bet it is.
I'm calling him 50 Shades of Shay. Because he gives you like 50 shades to each line you ask him to read. That's how he is. He's like, he will not let go of a line until he nails it, because he's scared, especially with acting or portraying characters like Schmidt, that you know, push it a little bit too far into the place that it's overacting, or it's like a caricature, and it's nobody will believe this character exists. So but at the same time, he wants it to be funny, larger than life, and great, right? So he needs to tap into that moment where that line becomes this crystal clear, that he nailed the laughs, he nails the craziness, the quirkiness of the character, but it's not over the top. So that's 50 shades of shade to you. Like, it was amazing to watch him, you know, tuning himself for like sometimes, you know, like 10 minutes until he get that line the way it's perfectly nailed at the end of the movie. And it was a great experience. I learned a lot from him about acting. I think it's something to behold. And he's the best friend a director could have. He's like the biggest fan of the movie, more than the director, is Shea Whigham. He will call you every day to say how great he feels about the movie. He will months and months after, you know, production is finished, to make sure you're safe, you're good, you're loving whatever you have, and that you know that you are, you know, you made a great film. That's how he is. You know, every month, still a telephone call from the guy. He's such a sweetheart.
That's Michael awesome. Ter,
yeah, Michael Ter is like. I don't know how women reacts in the U.S. to Michael Ter when he
enters. I don't know how women react, but I know how I react when I see Michael.
In Israel, he's one of the biggest sex symbols I think there is. It's like when I told people I'm casting him to South of Bell, they're like, what?
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to check when I wrote Price. So Price on page could have been this, you know, over-the-top, exaggerated villain that you see in so many, you know, Southern noirs, where you just like, oh my God, this is like, you know, too much. So that's on page, right? So I thought that in order to make sure that it's not going to be over-the-top, I should get an actor that conveys so much fear and commands the scene and the stage so good, even when it's quiet. So when he reads the lines, and that's how we worked on it, he doesn't go over the top. He doesn't yell except for one crazy time. But he's just, you know, delivering the words as almost he's like, whispering them. And that's enough. And working with him was great because he's, and it's true about every good actor, they know more than the writer what their character needs. Because when you write like all sorts of characters. So, you wear too many hats as a cook. But they concentrate on their voyage, on their journey throughout your movie. And I remember that Michael Ter told me that as a father, he would believe this son when he says he's in an accident. And I told him, Mike, but your kid is a liar. He's like cry wolf all day. You're not supposed to, you know, you're bound to say, come on, man, you look good. Nothing happened to you. And he said, I still think we need something to end the journey with. And that's how the whole monologue scene just before Jimmy comes to his house.
It's so great.
It was born out of his reaction to the script and his need to end this journey and give it a payoff. So I just ran back to my room during pre-production, wrote that monologue, came back to Michael Ter the next day and I told him, this is the monologue. This is what you're going to do. This is a new scene for you. And he was like, Aaron, the journey ended for me. I thank you so much. And, you know, now it's one of my most beloved scenes in the movie.
That's amazing. You essentially, because of that feedback, what a collaboration. Because of that feedback, you were able to bang that out. And it's such an impactful scene and such a great story within the story, too, of why he wouldn't believe the kid. That's incredible that A, you guys were able to collaborate so well, but B, that you were able to just kind of on the spot come up with that amazing story to flesh out that character arc.
You have to listen to your actors, especially if they're intelligent and really want to help you better your scripts when you have the time in pre-production or even in previous conversation, because they know, I really think that they know better when they concentrate on their characters, what will be their motivations and how they should approach everything. They ask you a lot of questions. They have a lot of suggestions, just like you have. Some are good, some are bad, but, you know, they know and they have a great instinct. So, you know, for me as a writer, I always listen to the actors, always. Like, you don't have to agree on everything, but even in Big Bad Wolf, I had one great scene was born that in South of Heaven, even the scene at the beginning where they're going into the bedroom and you have that bathroom scene where he looks at his tummy and she looks at herself in the mirror. And then there's their timid first, you know, intercourse. So that was born out of Evangeline Lilly giving me a harsh criticism about a previous scene that was supposed to take place in a bathroom, in a bath, where it was really cheesy. It was like, damn, he's in the bath, he's pulling her in this bath, and it's like, oh, you know, they drink the beer, and
right.
Like, really cheesy, corny, shitty scene. I acknowledge that. So she said, look, Aaron, you know, you just asked me to watch The Getaway by Sam Peckinpah the other day. I want something as honest as Ally McGraw and Steve McQueen had in that film when he comes back when he comes out of prison. I told him, well, Evangeline, your wish is my command. I ran into my, you know, writing room and I just wrote those scenes where everything is just muted. And you could feel, you know, that they're timid. It's awkward. He's shy about himself. There's like this consciousness that things have changed during those 12 years, and it's not going to be like, you know, hey, let's go to bed. And I don't know if you would like to go to bed. You know, I have this big stomach now, and
they're worried that they're not attractive to each other anymore. It's a very refreshing, honest scene before that. You know, before they decide, all right, let's try to, you know, make the bedroom stuff happen again. You know, it is a very nice scene. I'm glad that she was able to talk you out of the thing that you wrote originally.
Me too.
Yeah. I tell you, there are a couple of real film nerdy moments in this movie. you open up the movie with a static one shot on Jason Sudeikis as he goes through this whole speech that he has been rehearsing in his head to the parole board. It's funny. I got the sense that the speech that he was rehearsing, that he was claiming not to say to the parole board, was the speech that he was giving to the parole board during this whole thing. What is it like making a scene like that? How many takes did it require for you to get that scene done?
I think we did, because it was like 25 days of shoot, I think we did like between 5 to 6 takes.
Really?
Yeah. Which is not a lot. Jason, like, I think what brings it honesty is when you tell an actor he has to, you know, to deliver a monologue in one take, no mistakes are allowed. It brings the, you know, vulnerability to their performance, and it brings some hesitation, like natural hesitation and fear that they might, you know, screw up the monologue, right? Screw up the take. So what happens is like real magic, because then if you think he's maybe it's the same, you know, speech he worked on in his cell, it's mm-hmm. because, you know, Jason Sudeikis has worked with it, has worked on it as a actor working on a spontaneous speech that is not really spontaneous.
Right.
So it's like that creates magic for me. You know, that's what I look when I look for, you know, performances, I'm thinking about what could create the same situation for the actor that it could deliver the best moment for the opening scene as a guy who just needs to bring improvised speech to the parole committee. And when I saw him, like, there's a couple of great stutters at the beginning. It yeah. feels like he's like, you know, it's like a car, right? It's you're starting a car, and it builds up. Like he needs to feel his rhythm and tempo during that speech himself. Like he tries, he stutters, he doesn't really, you know, make it smooth, but then it becomes smoother and smoother and smoother. And by the end of it, when you see that she's asking him a follow-up question, he knows he nailed it. So he's like, I have the confidence now to bring it home and win the show. So I think that helped, that creating that one shot helped the scene to be as spontaneous and rehearsed at the same time and feel like something that you could say. Maybe he did it. Like for me, I don't have the answer. He might have just, you know, I wanted that scene to end with his smiling, because I wanted the actors to think, the audience to think, is he shitting them? Is he just pulling the leg?
Yeah.
You know, is it like something he really didn't, you know, did he rehearse it? Did he even, does this woman really, is this woman really dying? So I wanted all these questions, right, an opening scene to be there. And I think that when you don't show the reactions of the parole committee, which is a very bold move, especially mm-hmm. when you show this cut to you know, to your producers, and but then something happens. You just need, you are standing in there, you're sitting in the parole committee as an audience, and you have to decide, is Jimmy bluffing you? Is he worthy yeah. of your, mercy? And then you get the answer, right? You hear the gate opens.
Yeah, yeah. I particularly like that, and exactly how you described the effectiveness of it is what I brought out of that. It was, if you cut through that scene, it just doesn't, I don't think it has the same, it doesn't have the same impact. You have another one shot in this movie, that we don't need to spoil what happens during it, but tell me what it was like, creating that shot towards the end of the movie. How difficult was that to stage?
It was quite difficult to stage. And again, this is something that happened during pre-production, because when you co-write, sometimes your co-writers think of action scenes that are much bigger than the movie that you had in mind. So yeah. The original scene that you're talking about was supposed to be like this almost John Wick kind of
right.
where he bashes the gate with a car, get out of the car, take the guard by his neck and using him as a shield towards another, like, you know, Jason Sudeikis doing Keanu Reeves moves for like 5 to 10 minutes. That was this, like in the original script. But then, you know, once I cast the movie and saw the way the entire scene works and saw that, you know, I have 25 days of shoot and saw that I rewrote the monologue for Price, I said, wouldn't it be more interesting to do a movie where the last shootout will be through the point of view of the villain, as if turning the tables and, you know, changing the protagonist? Because I always believe that the best writing, the best writing advice I could give to writers is always write your villain as a guy that always write the villain as the guy who has a hero as a villain in his life, right? Because that's how he sees it, right? Hans Gruber in Die Hard is a good guy who worked a long time on a brilliant plan to rob money, right? And then comes this shitty John McClane officer.
He really fucks everything up.
The guy worked for a year probably for that screw going to get, you know, all the design, you know, all the plans for floor plans, the right dates, everything up to the last detail. And then, you know, and John McClane cries, I got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. No. Hans Gruber is the real victim of Die Hard. You know? So, that's how I write movies. And that's what I wanted to do with South of Eden. Like, you know, you change the point of view at the end of the movie that, but that was only in script. But then I thought I could do it also visually. I could make a case for making the monologue, and then instead of going into the mansion with, you know, Jimmy Ray, I will do it through the point of view of the villain. Now he's having a home invasion movie, right? And I decided to shoot it as a home invasion horror film because it's always De Palma with the stage.
Yes, very much so.
It's not like, it's not no cuts, it's one take. So I said, let's make a horror film out of the best moment this hero is going to have in the movie, but nobody's going to clap their hands. Nobody's going to, you know, want to have that shootout at the end. And nobody will clap at the end result. It will be like a frightening moment. So I designed very meticulously with Matt Mitchell, RDP, a plan to make Jimmy not a protagonist in his own, you know, vendetta against Price. And how you do that, you just make the camera lose him and find him, lose him and find him. So he's not the major point of view of that shootout. He's not the guy who runs you through everything in the house. Sometimes, you know, you stay outside and you go with the henchman and enters the house with him, not with Jimmy. And that's how I feel that you can break a perspective, a point of view, and create a horror show out of a mundane action scene that you saw so many times in your life.
Yeah, I loved it, guys. I guess we're up against the time here. Do you have any other questions, Barrett, Jonathan?
I just have one practical question: is that Jason's real hair?
Yeah.
No, it can't be. No.
Yeah.
That hair is luxurious. It's gorgeous. It can't be real.
It's real, and it has a life of its own. I assure you. I saw it every day on set and was like amazed of how great it looks. Yeah,
it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. Yeah, that's my contribution, by the way. This movie is so fascinating, Aaron. I really appreciate you. It reminded me very much. Chris mentioned To Die For earlier. I was thinking about Lone Star. I was thinking about like these mid to late 90s, U-Turn even, like these mid to late 90s just thriller action movies that don't seem to be made very often anymore. And this seems like it's kind of an elevated version of that. I thought it was fantastically bonkers and lovely, and I appreciated you making it.
Thank you so much for saying such great words and you know, talking about these movies, because I do miss those 90 movies. I think Hollywood was crazier, ballsier, better when they allowed for, you know, narratives like that to happen in the mainstream. You know, I did it mm-hmm. for like $3 million. Back then you could do these movies for like 20 even. And Warner Brothers will be behind directors that will bring them crazy, you know, tales, Texas tales to the table. And I miss those movies. And I think I did it for my wife. The second reason was I wanted to go back in time and, you know, make a movie like Blood Simple, make a movie like, you know, like you said, Lone Star, make a movie mm-hmm. like Red Rock West. You need, it's so much fun. It's surprising and it's always bonkers. And, you know, I wish there was more freedom to make more films like this in Hollywood. Yeah.
You're speaking absolutely. Our language. Absolutely. 100%. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank Aaron for giving us his time today. The movie is South of Heaven. It comes out in theaters, VOD and digital on October 8th. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Aaron.
Thank you for having me. It was fun. Real fun. Thank you.
Absolutely. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson, Barrett Sher, and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.